Mr. President, Mr. Chief Minister, and friends, it is indeed an honor for me to be present here this morning and meet you and talk to you on behalf of the Congress Party. When I say that on behalf of the Congress Party, I am not authorized by the Congress Party to come here. This is a self-imposed duty at the behest of your chambers to come here and try to explain the point of view of the Congress as I have understood it. This is really speaking a very opportune occasion in this sense that we are discussing the political parties and the political programs at a time when country is getting psychologically prepared to understand these problems. We are near the general elections, and I am one of those who look at the general elections as a great opportunity for political education of the masses. And you won't mind if I include you in the masses. Understanding the political problem, as you very rightly said, is very vital to every citizen of a democratic government. And therefore, it's a welcome opportunity for every political party to come before an audience like this and try to explain, not defend. Because I have not come here with a conviction to carry conviction to you. But I have come here to explain my convictions so that possibly you can compare yourself and try to take a detached and objective view if you can. You very kindly say that I am going to have a last word. I wish I had a last word in this matter. What I propose to do, because the subject is such vast and the aspects are so complex, that I will confine myself to make a brief preliminary statement about the historical background of the Congress Party, the historical task which is before the Congress, and the different strategies that Congress has adopted to fulfill this historical task. I would not go into the details of policy matters because it is not possible, humanly possible, to deal with such a subject in a short time which is allotted to me in the beginning of 45 minutes. But I am certainly looking forward to a session of questions and answers which possibly might give me opportunity to speak on matters and problems which you want me to speak. Congress Party has both advantage and disadvantage. Advantage is this way that it has the greatest opportunity in the history of India to be responsible to carry its affairs immediately after independence. A disadvantage, it is the only party which has the responsibility of fulfilling the promises it gives. The other parties are in a very favorable position of either being a witness or being a critic at what's happening. Of course, it is neither their fault nor our fault. Congress Party, in a technical sense, is a political party. Immediately after independence, it became one of the parliamentary political parties which fights its elections on its manifestos based on its objectives and its political philosophy and runs the administration from day to day, from year to year, nearly for the last 20 years. But if I may try to put that other aspect before you, it is not purely or merely a political party. Congress also is a people's movement. It's rather strange phenomenon in the political history of India. If you want to judge a political party, you must ultimately try to find out what is the task it is supposed to fulfill. In order to understand the political party, one must find out how it grows and why it grew, what are its origins, what is its genesis. And certainly those historical advantages Congress has, even though it is a parliamentary political party taking the responsibility of a political administration after a certain period, it has also its certain traditions. So what is Congress as a political party today? Is shaped by the political and other social economic considerations of today, but at the same time it is influenced and shaped by certain historical heritages it has honored to belong. The Congress of Dadabhai Nauroji was not the Congress of Gokhale. The Congress of Gokhale was not the Congress of Lokmanya Tilak. Congress of Lokmanya Tilak was not the same the Congress of Gandhiji. Congress of Gandhiji was not perhaps the same of Pandit Nehru. And Congress of Pandit Nehru perhaps may not remain the same in days to come. Please don't misunderstand what I am saying. I know what you will tell me. It hasn't changed radically, if I may say so. Recently I was traveling in Himalaya and I saw the Ganges at Rishikesh. I saw the Ganges and its previous stretches before Rishikesh. Then I saw the Ganges at Allahabad, at Patna and near in Calcutta. It is the same Ganges. It is the same holy Ganges. I'm not trying to compare Ganges with Congress, please don't understand again. I'm taking illustration. It is the same Ganges, it is the same flow. But it was different. The Ganges of Rishikesh is not the same at Allahabad. It's not the same at Calcutta, it's not the same at Patna. It is in this sense. It's a historical process which is leading that movement, meeting the different problems, different aspirations of the people, meeting the different challenges of history so that it meets them, sometimes succeeds, sometimes fails, but it goes on ahead. So you will have to look at the Congress from this point of view also. It is not merely a political party, it is also a people's movement. And when I say people's movement, that means it is organically linked up with the urges of the people, the emotions of the people, the demands of the people, angers of people, loves of people. And therefore it is not bound by any inflexible doctrines. It is certainly so vitally linked with the lives of the people that whenever it looks at certain things as doctrines and fundamentals, they are the fundamentals of people's lives, which really speaking shape those fundamentals. So perhaps you will have to look at these basic aspects of Congress before you take a judgment of the Congress. Again, it's rather a very strange phenomenon. When I also look as a student of history as to what's happening to Congress in the last 20 years, I am a member of Congress, I am a minister of Congress government. I am perhaps one of those very fortunate people who have been continuously ministers at different levels and different places for the last 20 years without a break. So I am one of those who possibly is the most benefited person, if you look at it from my personal angle. From at the same time, I try to look at it rather more objectively. Congress, some people say that Congress has the advantage of being the leading party, the ruling party of the world. It was the instrument of achieving the independence of India, and therefore it's running away and getting away with all the advantages that it had. I would request you to look around our country and look at the history of last 20 years of many different political parties which were also responsible for achieving their own independence in their respective countries. You can look at the Muslim League, which was responsible for the establishment of Pakistan, and what is its fate. You look at the very leading political party, what a sort of a united front which was responsible for the independence of Burma. You can look at what's happening in Indonesia. You can have a look at Ceylon. It's not criticism of those parties. It is not difficult. It is not criticism of those countries. But with all the difficulties and with all the criticism, with all the adversities, political and economic and social, strangely enough, this party has succeeded, not merely remaining the ruling party of this country, but making its utmost to sticking up with all the difficulties and with all the defects. I am not come here to say that there are no defects in any organization, any program, any implementation, any human leadership. That's not my talk, that's not my job. I am not come here to defend that. But you look to the fundamentals. That this party, after independence, it has not merely remained a ruling party of this country, but at the same time, it has tried to make an honest effort as far as objectives are concerned, as far as policies are concerned, to stick to those basic urges of the people and try to carry on. So it is not just, I mean, and why I'm mentioning this aspect, because it proves that it still is basically a people's movement. What is the task of a political party in the country? The task of a political party in the country, as I said, that there are certain historical challenges which country's economic, social life throws. And has the party a philosophy, has the party objectives which is capable of meeting these challenges and solving the basic problems of the country? That, really speaking, is the test of a political party's success or otherwise. That's the test why a political party should remain a political party or should not remain a political party. And the main task that this country today has, or possibly 20 years before has, is the same. Basically, it is the same thing. We talked of political independence, but we at the same time wanted to know why political independence. And those of my generation possibly would remember that we went through a classic struggle of not merely making an emotional appeal for independence, but trying to understand what independence stood for. What is the content of independence? It was not enough to have a Swaraj. So what is the meaning of Swaraj? And I remember in 1931 when Sardar Patel decided, or Karachi Congress, a very important effort was made to define what the content was. So, the Congress program reflected the objective necessities or objective demands of the people. Those demands basically are to change, if we come back again, those basic demands after independence were the unity of India. You see, these words have become now an accepted term. But we are not, really speaking, gone into the real political meaning of those terms. It was unity of India. It was a democratic setup of India. It was changing the economic conditions in India. It was bringing about that sort of a social order where there will be a feeling of equality, or atmosphere of having equality of opportunity, a feeling of well-being, a feeling of partnership, a feeling of participation in every citizen. I am putting it deliberately in a general way. I am not trying to give it a doctrinaire phraseology. I am not trying to use the doctrinaire phraseology, which sometimes frightens people. That was, really speaking, the basic urge. And if you look to the last 20 years, I'm sure somebody would get up and ask me, what is the performance of the last year? I can certainly, I do not want to burden anybody with any statistics. It is a message that you are, all of you, students of economics, students of current affairs, so you yourself possibly are capable of checking upon those facts. But if you look to the last 20 years, the first 4 years, really speaking, went on laying down the real foundation for a democratic republic state. Today we go in a market and purchase from a bookstall a copy of the Constitution. It is so easy as that. But getting a constitution, a democratic constitution in the country, is a very important revolutionary process. You possibly can look to the history of France, you can look to the contemporary history of Russia, you can look to many other countries whose names I do not want to mention because possibly that might be misinterpreted. I had mine in Pakistan. You remember in 1917, when the Russian Revolution took place, when Tsar was defeated and Mensheviks came in power and they wanted to give a democratic constitution. But before long they were kicked out, somebody else came in and they had their own constitution imposed on it. The history of French Revolution is well known. I need not go into that. Pakistan certainly became independent. But what sort of constitution it had and when it is likely to change, on what basis and wherefore, neither the people nor the rulers themselves know. But this country went through a peaceful democratic process. To have a constitution for this country, a democratic constitution for the country, which is the basic charter for the people of India. The unification of India is a great task. And I may tell you, constitutional unification has taken place. But the further strengthening of this process is still on. It is not yet complete. India, the great country to which we have all honor to belong, very few of us still emotionally even understand what India is today. I didn't understand India today. Today's India, emotionally, before I saw it actually. Intellectually, I had understood as seeing the map, heard the songs and sang the songs, and I was inspired by patriotic feeling that this is my India and I must die for it. As millions of other young men in this country felt, I also did feel the same way. But when I went round looking at different parts of India today, I have a feeling that this process of cementing the unity of India is still on. I have many times mentioned this fact, but I can tell you from my own personal experience when I was a young political worker, age in 46 or 45, that Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru was writing a book in Ahmedabad prison, and it is going to be named Discovery of India. I was rather surprised, I can tell you. I was offering my mental criticism. Here is a leader of India whom we are worshipping like God, and he's still discovering India. But when I started going around the country, I can tell you from my personal experience, I found even today I am trying to discover India. The India on the banks of Sindhu at Leh, the India in the valley of Brahmaputra, the India in the valleys and mountains of Nagas, India in the deserts of Rajasthan, the India on the banks of Narmada, Sabarmati, Tapi, Krishna, Godavari, and if you go down south, India full of varieties at the same time, basically the same India, but we are still to understand it. So the unity of India, don't suppose it is just something which is unromantic idea. It is still an idea which should inspire you, me and everybody. And if you have to think in terms of the unity of India, you must have a political party which are not merely, it's not enough to have merely an intellectual approach to these problems. You must have something on the ground, in the field, to reach those people in there and link them to the central thing called India. So, very important factor in building up a political structure in India, you must have a political party which is really speaking Indian in that sense. It's not enough that I can start another institution tomorrow calling it All India something. Whether you have got the approaches, the organizational links, which can not merely have some office in some place or other, but whether you have got the mechanism to reach the minds of people in those areas, and where you can bind them together in a certain central thing, which is called India. Therefore, I'm trying to just make, as I said in the beginning, trying to make a preliminary statement indicating towards the fundamentals of things. So organizational of a political party, if it still to remain a people's movement, then you must have a mechanism whereby you can still keep that aspect of your party, aspect of your life, which can link the party, which link the mind to the people's mind. So this is an organizational strategy, as I call it. The Indian politics requires certain organizational strategy. Kindly excuse me, as a defense minister, I'm using the word strategy. It has not the same defense meaning as in a normal sense. A certain methodology. You must have certain methodology in organizational matters. You must have certain economic strategy also. What is economic strategy? This country requires, I would say, the party program ultimately must be judged on what are the basic requirements of the people in that particular field and whether that party meets those things. That is the test. On that test, I am trying to judge a party. A, B, C, D, E. Why Congress? Whether Congress is capable of answering these basic things in different branches of people's life. One thing is very certain, that India needs change. I am making an absolutely simple statement. India needs basic change in its economic life. Is Congress capable of providing this dynamic change? And here you can certainly compare many political parties. I am rather surprised that today even some political parties can think of, can imagine of, becoming really the national parties to lead the country in future with a program of status quo. Well, it may threaten sometime, somewhere, but as a student of politics, I think these parties, really speaking, belong to the past. It's not a criticism of individuals. I'm only trying to understand those political parties. Now, take, for example, can you in this country, in this century, think of laissez-faire? Look to the people. It's not enough that you only look around yourself or your neighborhood where you live or the town that you live. If you look to the entire mass of people, what are their problems, what are their demands, what are their aspirations and urges? If your political party is not going to meet them, what I individually feel may be good for me, may be relevant for me. But if I still persist on these things, well, I'm going to belong to the past. Are you going to tell people that best of you only, you do whatever you like, those who are best can win the race? It looks very fair. Superficially it looks very fair. But it is asking a sick man on the bed to join a marathon race with a well-bodied, well-trained, well-disciplined person. Millions of people have suffered from poverty, ignorance for centuries. It's not merely, I don't put that whole blame at the door of the British Empire. There is something lacking in this country. Some stagnation has come around in this country. Not only during British period, but according to me, even before British period. If I am also analyzed why British people came here, that was because the stagnation has already started in this country. A dynamic society, a dynamic political approach defeated a stagnated society. That's what happened. Not that it does not mean that there were no great men in our society. But it does not mean that there were not cultured people in society. But what is happening to this country? As I am going to put the whole thing, the British power came here, succeeded, because they had got a very powerful Shastra, as I call it. It was not because of powerful Shastra, but also they had a powerful Shastra. They had a different outlook towards life, based on the industrial revolution that was taking place in that part of the world. And weapon system, the ideas of commerce, ideas of trade and ideas of civilization, based on that scientific development, they came to India and they defeated us. It was very easy to defeat. So the stagnation was there in this country. Now we have to take this country out of this stagnation. How can you do that? That's the answer. Those who can answer those questions effectively in the shortest possible time have got a claim on the loyalty of the people in the political field. That is my presumption, that is my premises. Has the Congress got that program? And I take your permission to answer that question in the affirmative. The Congress has got that program. The country has to be taken out of this stagnation in the agriculture field, which is the biggest private sector. Sometimes in this controversy in our country goes about the private sector and public sector. I do believe in building a public sector in industrial sector today. But the biggest industry in this country is agriculture, and which is really speaking essentially, why essentially exclusively private sector, excepting few funds here and there. Now, what is his position today? What was his position 20 years before? And what is his position going to be in the days to come, in the years to come, is the important criterion, or as we may use our old phraseology, is the yaksh prashna, is really speaking the basic question of the Indian political life, the Indian economic life. How can you do that? Well, there were different aspects of the program which Congress party provided for the first time in Indian political scene. The land to the tiller, the economic holdings, cooperative servicing. These ideas were brought in and an effort was being made. How energetically, how far it succeeded, why it didn't succeed, these are the matters of details where one can criticize, one can compare notes, one can learn lessons and try to go ahead. But programmatically speaking, they have got the right approach to these problems. The other plank of the Congress program is planning. When you find there was stagnation in agriculture, there was practically nothing happening basically in the industrial sector, the economic relationship had to be changed, because when you say that you want to change a society dynamically, what does it mean? It means you'll have to change the economic relationship between the different classes of the society. I'm not using the word class in the terms Marx used it. I'm not using the terms in the sense of that having started the class struggle of the world population. But there must be some change, basic change in the economic relationship of the different sections of society. How do we do that? When you find that a large mass of people, half starved, half fed, with no opportunities for education, no opportunities for not only enriching their mind, enriching their bodies. You cannot say that, we are trying to lead this country towards progress. Congress undertook it and tried to implement it. How successfully, how badly, what mistakes were committed is again a matter of discussion, debate, where sometimes you can score a few points, I can score a few points. But the basic approach, what is wrong there about? Let us go to the... So therefore, there was this economic strategy based on the planning for progress. Let us go to the foreign affairs strategy, which is also very important for a country. Because, see, I am mentioning these things in a different way, but really speaking, they are also very intimately interconnected. They are coordinated. The foreign policy of this country, which is based on non-alignment, it was not some people think it was just fad of Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru. Certainly, Pandit Jawaharlal ji articulated, give it a specific form, and try to apply it in relation to the existing economic affairs as they develop from day to day. But according to me, really speaking, this policy of non-alignment had its germs in the policy that Congress followed during independence struggle. In this part of the world, if you look at this part of the world, and again take a general view of the world as then existed, because the world of 1948 is not the world of 1964-65. Lots of changes there. Two, there was a sort of polarization in the world, a socialist world and non-socialist world, if I may put it in that way. Now, when this polarization was taking shape in that sense, and two blocks were struggling for their influence, was it wise for this country to just hook itself to one side? Those who tried to do have not much gain thereby. It is a policy for a country of the size and of tradition of history like India. It was a policy of independence. It was not a policy of running away from this block or the running away from that block. And I can tell you from my own personal experience, even as a defense minister, that even today we are getting all the fruits of policy of non-alignment. Well, certain things do change. If you see the situation in the world affairs today, many, many fundamental things have changed. The socialist world of 50s has not remained in 50s. It has not remained that homogeneous monolithic group as it used to be called. Kosygin's Russia is not the same as Mao's China. And naturally, it has its own repercussions on the situations about us. If you ask me to draw a diagram, I mean, looking to the world position today in this part of the world, Asian world, and the nearby countries, if I am asked to draw a diagram, I would say draw a quadrangular, draw a line joining Moscow and Peking and Delhi, Delhi and Pindi and Moscow. I hope to get some sort of a quadrangle. Now look, if you see this merely quadrangular, what was the position in 1915? There was line of communication between Moscow and Peking. There was a line of communication between Peking and India. And there was also a line of communication diagonally from between Delhi and Moscow. There was a heavy line between Pindi and India, Delhi. And there was no line at all between Pindi and Moscow. 60s, what is the picture? The diagram is changing. There is no line between Moscow and Peking. There is no line between Peking and Delhi. But diagonal lines exist. A diagonal line from Delhi to Moscow and from Pindi to Peking. A new situation is arising. This is a changing situation, it's a changing world today. Really speaking, what's happening in China is of great importance for you and for me. Naturally, it will be very interesting to see, and everyone must be asking that question to himself, what is the significance of the present cultural revolution that is taking place in Moscow, in Peking? When the interpretations started coming in, immediately those who think in rather classical politics, in terms of classical politics, when I say classical politics, immediately when there is a power struggle, one starts to feel, well, A wants to defeat B or B wants to take place of A, and therefore C is trying to play with A and B and so on and so forth. That's how we try to normally interpret politics. The first reactions also started coming that, well, there seems to be a struggle. Who after Mao? But as we try to look deeper into what's happening there, it doesn't seem to be that sort of a classical or conventional interpretation likely to be correct there. Mao seems to be worried about, not Mao, she's worried about thought of Mao, or Maoism, if you would like to call it. Because he saw another history happening in Russia. Could Stalin ever imagine what would happen to his Stalinism after his death? Immediately after Stalin, some Khrushchev came and completely changed the picture of his thoughts, his ideas. I think Mao seems to be frightened as to what's going to happen to his thought after. He's trying to consolidate his thoughts. He's trying to push out people who are not likely to follow his line of thinking, his line of doing. But it's not merely that. What he is making is that Mao China is taking a more militant military attitude, getting it poised for some sort of a military adventure. Where, when, how? One can't say about it. But the present poise of China, politically and militarily, is something that should not merely worry Indians. I think it should worry practically every sensible man who has got some sort of faith in the democratic philosophy of life. And now when such an important thing is happening in the world, as I said, this is an event of world significance. It's happening, and happening for the first time for India across its borders. Sometimes many, many important events happened in some part of the world. And they were very important, they also influenced us and shaped our lives. But this time we appear to be coming nearer the center of the world events. Some revolutionary things are happening, which has got dangerous potentialities. It's just happening across Himalayas. This is very important to you, me and everybody else. So this is the type of world which is changing world. What do you do? Just get frightened and say, no. I hang my heart on your side. Do you do that? Or you try to stick to your own ideas. Try to stick to your own strength. Try to stick to your own strength of your own people and prepare your people for that. However big military power may be, it doesn't ultimately can give a guarantee of anything. I mean, let us learn the lessons of what's happening today. I'm not taking any particular political positions about it. I'm not supposed to do that. But I'm merely looking to the objective facts that's happening. That one thing remains and one thing stands up powerfully. That the biggest military power of the world is not capable of defeating a very small group of people, a determined group of people. Who is wrong, who is right, I'm not concerned about it. I'm not speaking on the merit, political merits of it. I have my own views about it. Don't suppose I have no views about it. But I'm not here for that. But I'm just merely pointing out your fact that a group of determined people can fight the greatest power on the earth. It is the will of the people, it is the determination of the people, it is the mental attitude of the people that really speaking is the base of any political philosophy, any foreign policy, any economic policy. It is the people that matter. And therefore what Gandhiji, Nehruji and leaders before that tried to do was to prepare the people for these things, and I personally feel that the Congress represents that urge. I hope this laughter is the laughter of approval. So non-alignment, really speaking, is not just saying that, well, we are friends of you, friends of that. We want to be friends of us. That is our basic thing. In this world, when we say that we want to have a world peace, and you can't have a world progress without prosperity without world peace. When you want to have a world peace, you can't say that we want to be only friends of this or that country or that country and not of this and other country. Even we have got our problems with Pakistan and China. But when you say that we'll never become friendly with this country, we never say that. We can't say that, we should not say that. Even today I've got problems on the frontiers with Pakistan. Even today they are trying to make certain moves here and there. And they certainly the concern of you and concern of me. I have to keep myself busy with seeing as to what's happening every inch or the other side. But therefore, I have not made my philosophy that Pakistan is going to be my enemy for all time to come. Even today I don't call it enemy. I only try to tell them, don't try to be bully. If you try to be bully, well, I will have to do what I did last time too. I mean, that sort of a thing. It's a question of trying to tell them, because this is also another way of dealing with bullies. But we don't say that our philosophy is more the philosophy of enmity. It's a philosophy of friendship. We want to be friends with them. Certainly we have learned our own lessons. Even with China, we said, there was a time when we used to say that Hindi Chini Bhai Bhai. I have said this. And I'm sure all of you have said it. As your representative, when I was the Chief Minister of bigger bilingual Bombay, I went to Santa Cruz Airport to receive the then, even today is the Prime Minister of China, Chou Enlai. I had told this story all over India wherever I go. Chou Enlai, they came and stepped out of his plane and they raised his hand and gave a big slogan, Hindi Chini Bhai Bhai. Naturally, as a host, I was just standing below the steps. I also raised my hand and said, Chini Hindi Bhai. So I have said it, and I have said it as your representative then, and you are not disclaiming me. But later on I learned that I had cloth in my hand for him, and friendship in my heart. But history showed us later, that they had deceit in their heart and dagger in their hand. We have learned our own lesson. But even though we are not given up our philosophy, but we still want to be friends with all the countries. So that will be our basic philosophy. But you can keep friendship only on the basis of strength. So ultimately the basic problem then comes back here, that even if you want to succeed in your foreign policy of non-alignment or being friends with other countries, you must strengthen your base, which is the people. And the strength, you can really speaking prepare the people or strengthen the base of the people by keeping them well contented, giving them hopes of progress. And if you want to give them hopes of progress, you will have to have that program for progress. And this is exactly what Congress ideologies, Congress objectives are, Congress programs are. And this is what is being pursued for the last 20 years. How far we have succeeded? Well, not well enough. Not as I would have liked it to happen, not possibly well as you would have liked to happen it. But there may be certain defects in the implementing machinery. There will be some mistakes at higher level, middle level, lower level. I am prepared to admit that, because this is not something that, I mean, one can merely talk as a lawyer in the course of law. But one thing is with history, through problems of the problems before you, we thought in 1951 when we took this strategy of economic planning and foreign policy and other things, we thought possibly we are likely to get a couple of decades, then we can energetically go around and achieve all the things that we wanted to do. You never knew this trouble likely to come from the north and Chinese side. We thought we could exclusively devote our strength, resources, manpower, and every ounce of energy for the development program. But now in the middle of second decade, you find that we are burdened not only with the responsibility of development, but we can then responsibility for the same problem, which also requires resources. And it has created problems. When we just never think about the economic problems, we certainly forget certain responsibilities that we have undertaken as a nation, not only as a party. So these are the basic things that ultimately you and I will have to look at and make our choices. When I say you look at a party, let's don't look at an isolated problem, an isolated issue, an isolated performance in A place or B place
are in so field of duties, when you are making the choice of a political party, or when you are trying to judge a political party, you will have to see the basic challenges the present era gives, the historical tasks that are thrown before the country or the nation before us. These are the questions and what are our answers for it. Which party is what program answers this problem is the ultimate test. And I have statistics to show what we did in what form, but I don't want to burden you with that, because that can be done by a pamphlet by political parties. I'm sure they will do that when the election is coming here. There will be competition of other parties showing out the mistakes of the Congress. Naturally, we are going to meet it with the information about what we have done. Well, there are areas where we may have failed. In human affairs, who can say that one would not make mistakes and one has not made mistakes? And that even I have the feeling that even God can't claim that so he has in that history. I think he has made many basic blunders, therefore the world is of this size that we are living in. But I can't take this complaint against God anywhere. And if at all it's a mistake, possibly he has sent us a challenge to corrupt it by ourselves. That's a fact. So this is now, Mr. Chairman, this is now a basic case for Congress, that this country has got challenges, because this country, sometimes I feel surprised whenever I hear these calls of funds, etc. I'm not describing a particular move, you don't understand it. But sometimes I ask, what is the fun of starting funds by ourselves? Really speaking, for centuries, British imperialism has kept India one. Our point is to unopen, I mean, open this one. The essential problem of this country today is to open up the minds of the people, the resources of the people, the awareness of the people, and meet this challenge and make that country a modern country. If in one sentence I can tell you what is the basic task for this country. In coming decades, first, you'll have to modernize your agriculture. You will have to modernize your industry. You'll have to open the opportunities for technological development and try to develop your defense strategy based on these two. Then alone this country will remain independent in India. Then alone this country will keep its heavy weight in the troublesome world, which is full of problems. And that is the task. Looking all around Indian political field, if there were a better party, I would not have hesitated to recommend it to you. But unfortunately, things as they are, I can only recommend Congress party.